Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does the name Mark Sanford ring a bell? He's a sitting congressman from South Carolina these days. And for a time, in the summer of 2009, as governor of the state, he soared briefly to the top of national newscasts when he seemed to have disappeared after announcing plans to hike the Appalachian Trail. He had little choice but to share the real story when he returned.
So the bottom line is this. I've been unfaithful to my wife.
By that time, my guest had been working on Sanford's communication team for a couple of years, and his new memoir about the experience is less a tell-all about Sanford himself than a deeply candid story of what it was like to work on his team, made up largely of staffers young and inexperienced enough to work for notoriously low wages. Swaim himself, Barton Swaim, figured the job of professional speechwriter would be an interesting way to put his Ph.D. in English to use. What he discovered was a job that challenged his self-esteem and faith in the purity of American politics more than his writing skills. Barton Swaim served on the communications team for former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford from 2007 to 2010. His new memoir is called The Speechwriter, A Brief Education in Politics. Barton, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Conventional wisdom is that young political staffers are the sorts of people who eat, sleep, and breathe politics. They idolize the elected officials they work for. That was not exactly the case with the team you joined.
It wasn't the case with me. I liked politics, and I liked to write, and I needed a better job. That was about all that was the case. But most of my colleagues did end up thinking and sleeping and sort of imbibing Mark Sanford all the time. It was strange. I was just thinking the other day how we used to, I'm sure this is true in a lot of political offices, we used to just use the pronoun he, him, and everybody would know who you meant. You know, he wants this. He doesn't like it this way. And you didn't even say the governor, or Governor Sanford. Yeah.
Did you think you knew what a speech writing job would be like?
I did. You know, all you hear about speech writers is presidential speech writers, and I knew of some of them. You know, Michael Garrison and the big names. And when I thought of speech writing, I thought of, you know, stringing together grand phrases and soaring rhetoric. Or
a thousand points of light.
Right.
Ask
right.
not what you can do for your country.
Exactly. Or maybe not, just at the very least, you know, just a competent speech that would be delivered as previously agreed by the politician, even if it was just to you know, the Farmers Association or whatever. But that is not what I spent most of my time doing when I got there.
One of the things you had to do was write these things that were called happy letters. Explain what those were.
Until the other day, I had forgotten that I put that in there, and someone asked me about it. did I say that? Yes. So happy letters were letters that were from the governor to anyone in South Carolina, or sometimes even outside, who had done something remarkable, you know, been promoted or appointed to some position or had achieved something or had done something and there was an article in the paper about it or something like that. The governor is one of those politicians. I call him the governor still, see. I'm talking about Governor Sanford. He was one of those politicians who wrote letters to everybody. It was just a discipline of his, and he had grown up, you know, thanking people, thanking relatives for gifts and this kind of thing. And he wrote to everyone he met, to, you know, it could be an important person, you know, a media person, another politician. It could be a guy he met on the street. And he would just write to say hello and acknowledge the person and say it was a pleasure to meet you and say a little bit, you know, in the way of a personal acknowledgement. And he wanted to do that for everybody, but he couldn't A politician meets too many people to acknowledge personally. And so I ended up writing a lot of those, but I had to write them exactly as he would have written them. So it was almost like they really were from him, because I knew what he would say after a while.
One thing you learned was that, like, a simple, clear, concise phrase would never do when you could throw in a lot of purple prose.
Well, the reason I put it that way was when you write to a person about whom you know almost nothing, if it's too short, it looks curt.
Mm-hmm.
And all you're doing really is saying hello and I remember you. But you can't say, dear so-and-so, I remember, you can't say exactly what you mean in that way. So, I didn't know anything about this person. I just knew this one thing. And so I would, in that situation, you use the maximum number of words to stretch what could be a two-line letter into, a full paragraph. It was sort of the opposite of the way you're taught to read, write, or the way you should write, which is with concision.
The idea that the governor wanted these out there, it's actually a lovely gesture, right? And regardless of people's
right.
politics, if you get a letter from the governor saying congratulations on whatever, winning the county mm-hmm. spelling bee or whatever, you're going to be charmed by that. The thing that stuck with you was that there are probably all over South Carolina hundreds, if not thousands, of letters framed in offices and living rooms and wherever that the governor literally knew nothing about. He didn't read them. He didn't ask for them specifically to be written. And he certainly wouldn't right. have remembered that he sent them.
That's true. And I hope not too many of those people read this book. what made me feel okay about it is that I know that he would have written all of those people. I mean, he would have done nothing but write letters if he could have. He really, he spent a lot of time doing this. And as I talk about in the book, the way I figured out how to write for him, because I was almost fired a few times. He didn't think I was writing in his voice sufficiently. And the way I figured it out was to transcribe his dictation. That meant these kinds of letters. And I just created a list of all of his favorite words and phrases. And after a while, I just began putting all those words and phrases into anything that I would write for him. And I kept my job, barely, but I kept it.
You actually had a list that I guess you tacked up next to your desk of words and phrases that came up a lot that when he saw them, he would think, well, now finally you're getting the message, Swaim.
Right. And I should say the reason I wrote the book was to tell a funny story. I didn't want to reveal any, there's no payback, at least I hope not. But so many of the experiences like this one at the time struck me as just bizarre and hilarious. In some ways horrible at the time, but when I looked back on them, I thought they were hilarious. And so this is one of those. And I didn't display my list. My list was kind of secret, and it was legendary around the office. It was like this magic thing, that I had. And because so many of the other staffers would write things for the governor, and he would hate them, and they would say, "Can I use your list?" And I would say, "No, I needed my indispensability." But I would write it for them, and the list was hard to create. It had words like phrases like "speaks volumes," given the fact that they were ordinary phrases, but they were particular to his own habit of writing. A whole host of, or in large measure, pearls of wisdom showed up a lot.
It sounds like, remember when you were like 14 and you had a 10-page paper to write and you would think of these grown-up phrases that you'd throw in there? It sounds like there were a lot of those.
Right. Nowadays, you just increase the font. Yes, and sometimes I would any writer trying to begin an op-ed, especially a political writer, so you're writing an op-ed, and it's not something that you would care about ex- except that you're paid to care about it. So your imagination isn't just set on fire, and you can't think of a way to begin it. So I would just stare at my list for a while, and I would see maybe a phrase like "given the fact that," and I would tap that out, and after a while something would come. And so he would still not like my writing, but he would see enough of his own strange voice in the document that he would not at least be outraged.
I will say about this book, before I started reading it, I wasn't sure what it would be. And people might expect a tell-all story of the scandal, and we'll get to that later, but it's not really at the heart of the book in the way people might expect. I have the sense that you might have written the same book had Mark Sanford never hiked the Appalachian Trail.
Absolutely, and I would have. When I, 2 weeks into the job, I thought, I have to write a book about this place. it was partly because when you're a writer for someone else, you're just in this intrinsically weird situation, and I thought it was funny. There are a lot of weird things that happen when you're trying to write in someone else's voice. And partly it's politics. Politics full of envy and shallowness and bitterness and backstabbing and all these things that make a great book. And partly, as you'll know from reading the book, Mark Sanford is an extremely difficult person to work for.
Yeah.
His kind of leadership style, if you could call it that, is to express extreme dissatisfaction with everything you do in the hopes that you do it better, which weirdly kind of works. Maybe it's not it's bad for turnover, but it worked. And so all these things seem to me good material for a really funny book. But what I discovered, and I started taking notes, fairly early. What I discovered was that you can't just write a book and string together funny stories. It sounds good in your head if you're a writer, but you have to have a narrative, a story. There has to be some kind of arc to it, and then in the process of trying to think about what that would be, the Argentina thing happened, and I had a lot of emotional responses to that, including anger and outrage. But somewhere inside me, I thought, well, there's your narrative. Thank you.
The way you write about that, it struck me for the first time ever, I'm embarrassed to say, what an impact a scandal like that or anything of that nature has on the people who have, in fact, dedicated years of their careers to working for an individual. It's not just the family who's embarrassed and affected. It really was kind of a blow to the solar plexus for the staff.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. And I was not one of those staffers who, show up at 7 a.m. and leave at 10 at night every day. There were some like that. I put in long hours, but I didn't quite sell my soul to the job. But all of us in some way felt that, well, we had done, so much advocacy for certain things, all kinds of issues that he cared about and that we cared about. And now we were just going to have to defend a politician from a scandal, and a ridiculous one at that.
Barton Swaim is my guest. He was on the communications team for former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford from 2007 to 2010. His new memoir is called The Speechwriter, A Brief Education in Politics. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Barton Swaim. He was on the communications team for former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford and has a new book out called The Speechwriter, A Brief Education in Politics. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Barton, I want to make it clear, I do not condone or endorse marital infidelity, but I have wondered in the past why a situation like what Governor Sanford did, which was disappear for a few days, saying he was one place, and in fact he was another place with his Argentinian girlfriend, mistress, whatever you want to call her, that could happen with a corporate executive who might in fact have access to a lot of our personal information, who might in fact have an impact on our finances, and we just assume that it's kind of sorted, but it's their own business. Why do we blanch when a politician does something like this that at the end of the day is really regrettable, but doesn't directly affect his ability to govern the state?
In this case, it was complicated by the fact that when he had been in Congress, he had not only voted for impeachment against Bill Clinton, but had also made a couple of pretty high-minded statements about the importance of fidelity. So that complicated things for us, as I well remember. He had left the state without telling anybody, which was, to my mind, not a big deal. Who cares if you can't find the governor of South Carolina? The legislature wasn't even in. And as I say in the book, I liked it when he was gone because I could get things done. You do feel that somehow trust is a thing that's important when you think about your elected leaders, and even if you don't care what he does on his own time, some part of you thinks, well, you at the very least you lied to your wife, that's what I think, and you know, somewhere inside I don't want to care about what he does with his on his own time, so to speak, but you can't help feeling that, well, that now there's now my thought about you or my view of you is tainted by a component of dishonesty.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hey, Chris, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I wanted to ask Barton a question about South Carolina. I went to law school in South Carolina. I've worked in politics there a little bit. I've worked in D.C. and in Texas politics and in British politics. And yet I have never seen a political community so, on the one hand, ostensibly Christian, and then secondly, so blood vicious. And I don't know if he has an opinion on that or why that is, that politics seems so much dirtier in South Carolina than just about anywhere I've ever seen.
Wow. I don't know that I have a good answer for that. Some of the viciousness, you're right. There, it's known for dirty tricks, and you know, Lee Atwater is a famous South Carolinian. Some of the viciousness I find a little overblown. The South Carolina is the first in the South primary, and so it's a third primary, and so things get really heated during that contest, and some of it is legendary, I feel. I don't have a good answer. South Carolina is currently, unfortunately, a one-party state, which even whether you're Republican or Democrat or something else, I don't think is ever a good thing, because so much ends up being done behind closed doors, and I feel that must encourage the kind of underhanded, just a feeling of corruption I don't know why, but you're right to perceive it, I think.
The South Carolina governor's office would seem to be a fairly prestigious place to work, but during the time you were there, most of the legislature, including members of his own party, rather openly disdained the governor.
Mm-hmm. This was 2009 was the year of the first Tea Party, and so we never heard of a Tea Party before that, and he was sort of Tea Party-ish. Not in an entirely crazy way, in the sense, you know, that term means different things to different people. But when he took office, he took on the state's political leadership, legislative leadership, in a very direct way, and in a way that hadn't happened before. I mentioned South Carolina being a one-party state. The Republicans run the show, but about a third of the Republicans used to be Democrats, and they just put an R after their name because that's what you do to win. And he found that very frustrating. And he loves talking about ideology and thinking through, you know, political principles. And the vast majority of South Carolina legislators don't want to talk about that at all. For them, it's just, you know, R or D. And he found that very frustrating, and he's the kind of person who, and I like this about him, I did then, and it's hard for me not to still admire him for this. He's a politician who's not afraid to make enemies, and really big ones who can hurt him. Any politician will make enemies, but they tend to choose very small ones who can't do very much harm. But he didn't care. I mean, I never seen anybody like that, and anybody who knows him will tell you he's like that in person, and he's like that in his approach to governing. He just didn't care, which made a lot of problems for us in the press office, but it was still fun, at least, and interesting and kind of unpredictable.
One thing he really felt strongly about was eliminating what he perceived to be wasteful spending, and this came down to having an incredibly small staff, even given the sort of relative size of South Carolina. There were like 15 people in your office, and that was it. Can you talk about Christmas presents for your team?
Well, the legend was, and I said this in the book because I don't know what the literal truth of it was, but the legend was that in his congressional days, he had assigned his wife, Jenny, the task of getting the staff Christmas presents. And she had spent some sum, you know, I don't know, $500 or something ordinary. And when he found out about it, he was outraged. And she was outraged at his outrage. And so from that point, they agreed that the governor would take over the task of assigning gifts. So what he did is just regifted everything. He was a world famous regifter, and you know, any politician will get gifts from people, you know, at a press conference or a stop you make or whatever. People give you a t-shirt or a whatever memorabilia, and they just a room full of this stuff, and he would just grab random things and hand it to and put a card with it and give it to the staffer. So one year I got a little box of shoe polish, and another staffer got a jar of preserves that was 3 years old, literally 3 years old. I got a t-shirt from some hardware company. And in a way, it was more fun than a Christmas present you really didn't want, but was a real Christmas present. So it was the occasion of great laughter, and it was one of the few bright points of the job, probably.
So what happened when he wasn't happy with something that you wrote? Describe what that would be like, because you write about many days driving into work feeling nauseated because you knew that you were in for 8 or 10 hours of stress.
Yeah. When his, yeah, I mentioned that his management of the office, the way, which is the way he operated, was just to dislike everything anyone had done, and to force you to do it again sometimes, And I think that he felt that this was getting better performance out of you. And in some cases it was probably because you really, really tried hard. But I would write an op-ed and he would come back and say that it was terrible from beginning to end. It looked like a sixth grader had written it. That sounds terrible, and it is terrible. But we all knew, those of us who were still there, that it wasn't personal. It was just how he dealt with you. And if you wanted to work there, and you just had to, there was just kind of an unspoken agreement that you're going to have to take this kind of stuff.
Well, you write in the book that it wasn't, excuse me for interrupting you, you write in the book that it wasn't personal because he would have had to know you and acknowledge your individual humanity in order to make it personal. That almost sounds worse to me than if he had kind of had it out for you specifically.
It was kind of terrible. It was the first time I traveled with the governor in the car, someone told me, he's going to throw newspapers at you. And I said, throw newspapers at me? And the person said, he's reading the newspaper in the front seat and you're in the back seat. And he's not really throwing it at you. He's just throwing it into the back seat because he's finished. But if you're in the back seat, it's going to hit you. And this happened. This is a true story. Sure enough, hit me in the head. And I thought about that for a long time. Why would he do this? He had to know I was there. But in a sense, I don't think he did, because for him, the people around him, the people working for him, were only there insofar as he needed them at the moment. And if he didn't need you, it was like you weren't there. And I don't, you could assign a lot of terms to describe someone like that, but it was, in part, at least, just an enormous ability to focus exclusively on the thing that you cared about. Most of us will have some contextual feeling for what we should say or do to those around us. But if you worked for Mark Sanford, it was like you weren't, literally. You just weren't. Until the moment that he needed you for something. And then once he had his focus trained on you, you were all he would think about for that moment, and it could be terrifying. This kind of thing was, I would think about this and ponder this, and that's really why I wrote the book, because that struck me as amazing and funny. It wasn't, meant to tell crazy stories about Mark Sanford. It was just that seems to be a remarkable trait in a politician.
Well, and the point here, again, seems to not be that you worked for one especially solipsistic politician. The point is that you suspect that many people who end up in these offices have a lot of personality traits in common with Mark Sanford. Does that depress you?
A little bit, yeah. I couldn't help thinking when I left the office, I can't help having something against every politician. And I've had innumerable discussions since I've left about how people think how some politician, not every politician is like that. I realize that. And I know that many politicians are beloved by their staff. Well, I don't know about many, but some are. And some treat them with basic dignity. But I find it hard to separate that experience from the way I view all politicians, because a politician is someone who is really good, at least as we have politicians who have to have just a majority of the electorate to vote for them. A politician is someone who is really good at persuading you to give him power. That seems to me to be an indication of untrustworthiness. A trustworthy person doesn't ask you for power or try to persuade you that he's trustworthy. He just is. And so I can't help holding these things against all politicians, try as I might.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Garvin in Lake Highlands. Hi, Garvin.
Hello, Chris. Let me ask you, and Barton, sorry. You've enlightened us in that now we know he's insensitive and rather cheap. But given as bright as a guy as this governor seems to be. Did he really think he could get away with that ridiculous alibi? And maybe he wanted to get caught just to get out of all of it. What is your take on whether he really thought he could snow everybody like that? And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for your call.
Right. And this bears on what we were just talking about. I didn't write the book just to, tattle on Mark Sanford, but this is going to be a kind of critical. I think that he was very popular in the national media when this happened. As I mentioned, the Tea Party thing had happened, and we were getting calls all the time from national media, and he was being described as one of the president's chief critics. And I feel that he was flying very high, and as often happens to politicians. And my own interpretation, I could be wrong, is that when this happened, he began to think that ordinary rules didn't apply to him. That's why I told the cake story, which you'll remember, Chris.
Yes. hold that off because we have a break coming up, so we'll get that right after the break.
Okay, yeah, we'll talk about that. But I told that when I did. He seemed to think that he wasn't like other people, and I think he just thought he wouldn't get caught. I don't know how he thought that he could tell his security detail to stand down, leave the country, and expect this not to be found out. Not in politics. He knew this. He flew too close to the sun.
Martin Swaim is my guest. He was on the communications team for former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford for 3 years and has a new memoir out called The Speechwriter, A Brief Education in Politics. We will tell that cake story in just a couple of minutes, and it's a good one. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Barton Swaim, who is a member of the communications team for former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford and has a new book out called The Speechwriter, A Brief Education in Politics. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, Barton, the cake story. There was a staff member who was leaving, right? It wasn't a birthday. It was like, goodbye, thanks for a good job.
It was her birthday.
Okay.
Yeah. And
go ahead.
I have it in front of me. Can I read it?
Please.
Would that be okay?
Yeah.
Her name was June, and a colleague and I had been in the office, in the governor's office, taking some notes about things that he wanted done. We scribbled everything down as he spoke, and after another 4 or 5 minutes, we were done. Chris and I walked out. I stopped at Francis's desk to ask about something or other. The governor walked out of his office a few seconds later, and incidentally, I've already told you that there's a birthday cake sitting there that says, Happy Birthday, June. The governor walked out of his office a few seconds later. He was about to say something to Lewis, his personal assistant, when he caught sight of the cake. Oh, he said, almost inaudibly. Then, with 4 or 5 of us watching in silence, he walked over to the cake, mumbled the words, Eat this tonight, picked up a knife, then cut a corner out of the cake and put it on one of the paper plates. He took the cake into his office and shut the door. Frances sat with her eyes wide, her mouth gaping. Did he just do that? I'm sorry, June said with a disbelieving smile. Did he just cut my cake and not even wish me happy birthday? Later, the staff gathered and sang happy birthday to June, presenting her with a cake with a corner missing.
It's so, like having a big bear in the office.
Right. If you or I, you know, walked past somebody's desk and there was a birthday cake there and the candles were in it and the candles had not been burned and the cake had not been cut, we wouldn't cut the cake.
Right.
Bizarrely, I watched it happen, and I wrote it down afterward because I did not want to forget this. He just cut the cake in front of everyone and seemed not to even know that this was unusual or that we were all watching him do it. So I put it there in the story. This was just before the Tea Party and the stimulus thing was happening, because what better way to describe someone who doesn't feel bound by ordinary human conventions anymore?
Did it make you angry when you would see him out in public being charming and self-effacing and then know that when he came back to the office it wouldn't be that way?
It didn't make me angry in the sense of thinking he was a hypocrite. The public persona versus private demeanor is a common distinction, maybe not to the extent that it was true of him, but it's common. We all know that politicians aren't the smiling, charming, happy people that we see in public. And in a strange sort of way, it sort of contributed to some camaraderie in the office. We would often joke that when he was out with the public, you know, say a group of school children stopped by the office and he would have to go out and talk to them, and he would be so charming and just a normal, down-to-earth guy to them. And someone would always comment that they were sucking the niceness out of him. And so when he came back to the end of the office, he'd be especially a beast. But I didn't think he was maybe he's a hypocrite for that, but I didn't think of it that way. It was just part of the job.
You said that to you and other members of the staff, in some ways the governor was like a drunkard father.
Yeah, that wasn't very nice to people who might have actual drunkard fathers. And I didn't mean it that way. But when we had to start defending him after the scandal, and I did have to start because I didn't have another job to go to. So this was my job. This is what I had to do.
And we should say you had a wife and three kids, depending on your income.
Yeah. Right. I would have gone somewhere, but I couldn't. When we had to start defending him, it was hard at first because we thought he was an idiot for doing this to us and to, you know, embarrassing the state and his own family and his staffers and all the rest. But this strange competitive dynamic took over where we didn't like him, but we hated his enemies. And we did. I mean, he had some of his fiercest critics were people we regarded, and I still regard, as deeply unscrupulous people. And in a weird way, that sort of helped us get through each day. So it was like defending a family member you knew was a huge pain in the neck, and an unsavory person. But he was our guy, okay? And you're not going to call him these things. It got us through the day.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Jack on the line in Denton. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
To your guest, a quick comment and a question. My career almost took me to Washington, D.C. as a speechwriter during the days of Sam Rayburn and Lyndon Johnson, and there's times when I regret that I did not travel that road, and so I admire your career. My question is, what is your take on how a politician faces the public as he now stands in judgment for something that he has so fiercely and harshly criticized someone else for, and now he has committed that same act? I just wonder how he goes out and faces the public, knowing that he did that.
My answer is I have no idea. It was there were lots of there were lots of ways, things that we could say to defend Sanford at the time. You know, it didn't matter if he was gone for a few days. It was a private thing, whatever. There were all kinds of things that you could say, but I found that the fact that he had criticized Bill Clinton for marital infidelity on at least two occasions, that was unanswerable. There was nothing that – there was no defense to be made. There was no explanation. There was no saying, oh, but the situations are different. They were exactly the same. How he faced the public, I don't know. He said that he thought about resigning, which I think he should have done. It would have meant that I would have been without a job because I was at will. But, you know, in theory, and I can say this comfortably now, having got another job, that I felt that he should resign. But he didn't. And I don't know how a politician does that, just stays in it and keeps taking the beating. I will say that one of the things that was not fun, but made the job a little more tolerable and interesting was that Sanford didn't care what people said about him, just did not care. And for him, I think his skin was so thick, he just figured, yeah, that's hypocrisy, but don't care, not going to listen.
All right, I want to play a little sound here of somebody else who maybe has that attitude, a politician who would probably be challenging to write speeches for, and then we'll talk a little bit.
I know what you're going to do.
Maybe when you run for president, you shouldn't be allowed to use a teleprompter because you find out what you're getting. Does that make sense?
That, of course, is Donald Trump, and he's referring to, you know, people are saying maybe you should use a teleprompter, you won't put your foot in your mouth, I believe is the context of that. Have you thought at all? Have you imagined your counterpart on the Trump staff?
Is there one?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm guessing he's got some kind of speechwriter.
Surely, right? Some politicians are, in fact, probably most politicians are too scripted, and everything that comes out is bland and vague and not very interesting. And some are not scripted at all, and that would be Trump. Sanford tended to be in the unscripted side. But most of the time, he didn't say just dumb, irresponsible things, and that was a political benefit. Media liked showing up to our events, even if they weren't politically significant events, because you never knew when he might say something interesting. And he had it's kind of the mental habit of always trying to say something other than what you expected at an event. Now, I think that this got him in trouble because when talking about an extramarital affair, you should say the thing that everybody expects you to say, which is, this is a private matter and I'm working things out with a family and whatever, whatever, and you're done. That's what you should say. But he tried to say something different and something that would somehow redeem what was just another tawdry political affair. And he ended up saying all this business about soulmate and who knows what else. I don't even want to remember. But the unscripted component, as long as you're not irresponsible with it, can be an advantage. But sometimes just stick with the script.
To be clear, he's no longer with his former wife or with his new soulmate today.
That's correct. Yeah, he broke up with the latter via Facebook.
Do you follow now Representative Sanford closely?
As I said, I didn't write this book to affect his political career in any way, and I've not been concerned with it. I don't think it will affect his career or do him any damage, and we haven't spoken.
When you look back on that time in your life, and again, I recognize that you were, you know, a breadwinner in your family and you couldn't just walk away from the job, but do you ever think, why did I put myself through this? I mean, because it was, I mean, there were a lot of blows to your own self-esteem working there, having this, like, PhD level of writing, constantly criticized. I mean, are you ever disappointed that you stuck around for so long?
I'm not. I wouldn't do it again. but it's an experience that I wouldn't trade for anything, and not only because I quote got a book out of it. I had a lot of growing up to do, and I thought a lot of myself, as we tend to do when we're younger, and having a really terrible, terrible job for a few years is sometimes the best thing that can happen to us, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
How did you know the tone of the book from the moment you started? As you said, it is a lot of it's really funny and written in a way that allows us as readers to laugh along with you. But were you sure that was the direction you were going to take from the beginning?
Yes, I wrote a few pieces for a London magazine called The Times Literary Supplement, and they were just stories about writing, and I didn't want to use the governor's name in those initially because I just didn't want any people Googling and finding out that I had written about Mark Sanford. And the tone in those, since I was talking to a British audience who didn't know who he was kind of deadpan. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to understated or something. Not explaining too much. And I liked the feel of those pieces, and they were well received, so I just did that throughout the book and didn't try to explain too much to the reader about what was going on. And I think people tell me at least, and I think it's funnier when you just tell it as curtly as you can.
So you live in Columbia, South Carolina. Is there any chance that Representative Sanford will swing through there? Is this in the territory that he covers as a U.S. representative?
It's not. I'm not in his district. That's in Charleston, down on the coast. I assume I'll run into him at some point, and I've rehearsed whatever I'm going to say, but I'm sure I'll forget it all, and it'll be super awkward.
Do you think he would pretend not to have read the book or not to know anything about it?
Well, that's what politicians do, right?
I can't recall.
When a book is unfavorable about them, they say they haven't read it. I think they always read it because when a lot of other people are reading a thing and it has to do with you and you're a politician, you're going to read it. So I'm sure that he has. But he's told reporters that has quote no plans to read it, which is fine either way.
Barton Swaim served on the communications team for former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford from 2007 to 2010. His new memoir is called The Speechwriter, A Brief Education in Politics. Barton, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show's email address or email box. It's think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.